10 years ago, Lyme disease from tick bites wasn't a big problem in western Pennsylvania. That's changed, and it's making people sick.
I can't go anywhere without a walker.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, we head to the woods to search for black-legged ticks and answers about rising cases of Lyme disease in our region. Plus, the Pope's call for action on climate change creates internal conflicts for some Catholics in coal country. And the Allegheny River provides the perfect backdrop for one man's obsession with America's favorite pastime. That's all coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Pope Francis is visiting the U.S. this week. At the White House, the Pope reinforced some of the messages in his environmental encyclical from earlier this year.
Climate change is a problem we can no longer be left to a future generation.
Some conservative Catholics say Pope Francis is meddling in American politics. Meanwhile, for the faithful in coal country, he's raising moral questions. Dan Boyce of Inside Energy reports.
Donna Zofson's husband was injured in a coal mining accident in Kentucky.
He got paralyzed.
For a time, anyway. Doctors helped him walk again. Then he died a few years later in 1992. Still, the walls of her humble Cheyenne, Wyoming home are an homage to coal.
This is some of the mining gear that they used.
The 78-year-old is pointing to a framed watercolor print of equipment.
Their mining cap, piece of coal.
She followed her daughter out here to Wyoming, the country's biggest coal state. So that theme still runs through her life. And so, too, does her Catholic faith.
Oh, we're very devout. And we go to church every Sunday.
We're in Zofson's church in Cheyenne. Sun streams brilliantly through the cathedral's ornate stained glass.
God indeed is the creator of all things.
Back in June, Wyoming's State Bishop Paul Achin delivered a special homily on the Pope's headline-grabbing encyclical on the environment, the biggest papal statement ever on the subject. A challenging and bold teaching, Achin says, which lines out humanity's responsibility to be good stewards of the earth.
So that it can continue to provide for future generations.
The document acknowledges the scientific consensus of man-made climate change and calls for aggressively addressing its core causes, primarily the use of fossil fuels. Achin says the document may be disturbing for many people in his state. And he says he's getting questions from his congregation.
Is the Pope saying that it's sinful to burn these fuels?
And he says no.
No, it's not sinful. But he's saying this is not sustainable.
That balance is a tough line to ride here in states like Wyoming, where coal is the economic backbone. So a lot of people in Cheyenne's church end up sounding like Paul Phillips.
I'll speak out of both sides of my mouth, I think.
He works for a heavy equipment company, and a good portion of their business is in the coal fields. So on one side, he says, yes, we do need to look for alternative sources of energy.
But on the other side of my mouth, I think that's going to be a long time coming.
And in the meantime, he believes these resources are a gift from God to be used as cleanly as possible. Conservative Catholic politicians, their stances on the encyclical have ranged largely from avoiding comment to accusing the Pope of inappropriately wading into American politics. Now, the church is no stranger to taking stands on controversial issues, take abortion, for instance. And Francis is actually not the first pope to bring up human-caused climate change. Both John Paul II and Benedict XVI urged action to limit its effects. Despite that,
the church has not always been the go-to organization for climate issues or environmental issues.
That's Jenny Kraska with the Colorado Catholic Conference, which lobbies the state legislature on behalf of the church. She says it's different now, with this popular pope and the special theological weight given to encyclicals. She expects her organization will pay more attention to environmental legislation.
To be involved and have an opinion on these issues as they come up.
And as for the conservative Catholic politicians who deny climate change?
I don't know that it puts them in a difficult moral quandary. I think it gives them a lot to think about.
Yet for other Catholics, like Donna Zofson in Cheyenne.
Does it leave you with difficult questions, maybe difficult moral questions?
It does. It does.
She agrees with the Pope that humanity needs to take better care of the earth to help the most vulnerable. Yet she's vulnerable herself. The coal company has been paying her a pension ever since her husband died. So her opinion on fossil fuels doesn't waver.
You have to see the way people live and how they live and what coal means to them before you can say, well, we need to do away with it.
As much as she loves the Pope,
he has his opinions and his perspective about it, and I have mine.
For Inside Energy, I'm Dan Boyce.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration that's focused on America's energy issues. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holzapfel. Incidences of Lyme disease have tripled in southwestern Pennsylvania in the last few years. Kate from Pittsburgh knows three people who've been diagnosed with it this year. She posted about it on I See Change because it seemed like a lot, and she wondered if cases of Lyme were up. Here at the Allegheny Front, we saw her post and agreed it did seem like a lot. I See Change, we should mention, is a public media collaboration that we're part of. It's a crowdsourced climate and weather reporting website. Anybody can log in to icchange.org and post questions or comments about what they're seeing outside. We decided to look into Kate's question. And well, Kate, you're right. The black-legged ticks that bite and cause the disease have recently been found in every county in the state. So I went looking for people who could help us with some answers about the rise in ticks and the increase in cases of Lyme disease. I started with someone who knows the disease all too well.
I know an old lady who was bit by a tick or some kind of bug, maybe a tick. She might get sick.
Mary Beth Takar is passionate about getting the word out about Lyme disease. She sits in her cool, dark living room in Beaver County in southwestern Pennsylvania, longing to be outside, picking late summer raspberries and green beans. But she can't climb the short slope to her garden.
I have had to use my walker ever since February. I can't go anywhere without a walker.
Her feet are numb. She's also lost 70 pounds and has sore joints, a more classic symptom of Lyme disease. Tekker thinks a tick might have bitten her in the garden, but she can't be sure.
I had not seen a tick. I had not had a bullseye rash. All these things, I thought these were necessary before you could get Lyme disease.
Pennsylvania has reported the most cases of Lyme disease in the country, and the numbers are only going up. According to the Pennsylvania Department of Health, in 2013, there were 5,900 cases. A year later, it jumped to 7,400. The state recently confirmed that there are black-legged ticks, those are the ones that transmit the disease, in every county of the state. Tom Simmons at Indiana University of Pennsylvania tracked down some of the ticks in that study himself. In a shady stand of trees on university property, Simmons is dragging an off-white curtain across jaggery barberry bushes and dried leaves below our feet. It's like he's swiffering the floor of the woods. He checks the cloth and sure enough finds a tick sticking to it.
Yeah, so this is a male tick that came off the barberry. It's probably pretty excited because it's probably detects our carbon dioxide.
This guy's an early bird or bug. The adult tick population is about to explode. By early November, this hillside will be covered with them as they molt from their nymph stage. Back at the lab, Simmons pulls out vials with more ticks he's collected. We look at ticks in three stages of development under a microscope: an adult, a nymph, and a larva.
You'll see on all of these that those front legs look a little bit longer.
The better to latch on to unsuspecting hosts and feed on their blood through long, pointy mouths.
They look more dangerous through the microscope.
A little more intimidating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Adult ticks can give you Lyme disease, but it's the nymph ticks that are the biggest concern. They're so tiny, as small as a poppy seed. You might not even notice they've climbed up a pant leg and latched on. They suck your blood, and within 4 days, they drop off. You may be none the wiser. Not every tick that carries Lyme bacteria will give its host the disease. Still, Simmons says the number of ticks with Lyme has grown. About half the adult ticks collected in their statewide study tested positive for the bacteria. Researchers don't know why. Simmons says some genetic studies are providing insight into why ticks are being reported in places like western Pennsylvania for the first time.
It's not that the ticks are here and the populations are increasing, it's that they actually are moving. I mean, they are migrating.
One theory is that there used to be plenty of ticks in Pennsylvania, But when early settlers cleared the forest to make way for farmland and hunted the deer to near extinction, the ticks retreated.
And they survived in pockets along the East Coast, including Long Island, where I'm from.
Now that forests have regenerated and deer are plentiful again, giving ticks a host to mate on and a vehicle to get around on, ticks are moving back to their old stomping grounds. Simmons says Western Pennsylvania is the western edge of this new tick recolonization and the huge growth of Lyme disease. But that doesn't necessarily explain why so many ticks are infected with Lyme bacteria. One theory for that? Climate change. Ecologist Tal Levy at Oregon State University says weather is influencing the timing of ticks' feeding cycle. Sometimes ticks in the nymph and larvae stages become active at the same time of year. But when we're experiencing warmer springs and summers, the nymphs wake up first. They feed on small mammals like mice and chipmunks and can pass Lyme bacteria to them.
Then the larvae come out later, and everything they feed on, every mouse they feed on, has already been infected.
That's how larvae get Lyme, and they grow into infected nymphs, repeating the cycle.
If you live in Maine or New Hampshire or even more inland systems like in Pennsylvania, you might expect Lyme disease to get worse.
Levy is studying how controlling those mice and squirrel populations could reduce the chances for ticks and people to pick up the disease. Meanwhile, back in Beaver County, Mary Beth Takar isn't giving Lyme disease the upper hand. She's already bought vegetable seeds for next growing season.
Because I'm planning to be out there planting my garden.
She'll just be spraying her pants and socks with insecticide before she does. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Kara Holsapple. We've been talking about the rise of tick populations and related illnesses in Pennsylvania, and how weather and climate may be playing some role in the life cycle of ticks and the spread of tick-related diseases. Dan Herms is a researcher at Ohio State University, and he doesn't study ticks, but he does look at how insects interact with woody plants. Think forests, orchards, or ornamental gardens, and how weather and climate affect, and sometimes disrupt, plants and insect cycles. That's something that interests a lot of people who've posted questions or comments at icchange.org. That's the crowdsourced climate and weather almanac. So, Dr. Herms, thanks so much for speaking with me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Some people have posted comments or questions on icchange.org about seeing an unusual bug in their garden or noticing flowers from a tree. Someone posted about apple trees blooming earlier in the spring and then producing fruit earlier. But a lot of times we don't or can't connect the dots with weather and then, of course, the larger picture of climate. But you do study the cycles and the seasonal nature of plants and animals, insects, you're an entomologist, and climate. So, and that's called phenology. So first, can you explain the concept of phenology? Kind of give us a phenology 101.
Sure. Phenology is the study of reoccurring biological events, like when things flower, migration times of animals, breeding times, when insects emerge, these kind of things that occur on a regular basis from one year to the next. It's been called the oldest science because the existence of humans, of course, is very tightly linked to phenology, planting season, birthing season of animals.
I was going to say, this is nothing new, and we were thinking about the old farmer's almanac, but it goes back a lot further than that.
Goes back eons.
In your research, you use it as a predictor for when certain insects may be visiting our area.
The development time of insects is completely dependent on the temperature. And so they develop faster in warm springs and summers and slower in cool springs. And so insects are basically a mobile weather station. And if you track the weather, you can predict very accurately when certain insects will appear or when plants will bloom.
So could you give me an example of an insect plant phenology from our region?
One of my favorite plants for monitoring phenology is a native shrub or small tree that's in the forest called the serviceberry. Serviceberry blooms around here in mid-April, and they call it serviceberry because the timing of its blooming corresponded when the pioneers would have funeral services for people that died during the winter, because the ground was now thawed enough to bury the people that had passed away during the winter. It's also called Juneberry because the flowers develop in June, and it's also called shadbush because at the time that the flowers bloom, the shad run up the streams from the Great Lakes to spawn.
So it's got a lot of connections with a lot of phenomena that are happening at the same time that are weather-related.
Right. It certainly does.
How can a change in climate or global warming, a warming climate, what are some of the ways it can affect plant and insect phenology?
Well, as the climate warms and as the spring warms, plants and insects develop faster and emerge sooner. So that's one thing. And as an example, we have a spectacular crabapple display here on campus. And it was always said that come on Mother's Day weekend, if you want to see the crabapples bloom. Well, now the crabapples generally bloom a couple weeks before Mother's Day. And we tell people to come the last week of April if you want to see those bloom. Another change is in the distribution of insects. And so as the temperatures get warmer, insects that formerly could not survive in a particular area because it was too cold are moving into that area.
I wanted to know if there were other implications for climate change and phenology. I understand that phenology is sort of chronological in that the order doesn't necessarily change. For example, the tree flowers and the insect shows up so many, you know, days later. Does climate change does it have any impact on that chronological cycle?
There has been documented what we call phenological asynchrony. And one example could be bird migrations. So as the birds come back in the winter time, they're not responding to the climate here. They're responding to cues on their overwintering ground. And when they get here, they can find that the insects that they're used to feeding on have already completed development, for example. And in some Arctic birds, it's already been shown that their breeding has been disrupted because of this kind of phenological mismatch between their migration time and the abundance of their food.
What is maybe since you've been looking at this so long, you've been looking at the data so long, what is the biggest change that you've seen?
You know, just kind of this general change of how, you know, much earlier things are blooming in Michigan, not only in my data, but also, you know, when we rake the leaves. You know, it used to be by Halloween, all the leaves were down. Now Thanksgiving and the oak leaves still aren't down. So the change has been pretty dramatic if you pay attention.
And this is something that worries you.
It does, because, you know, the thing is that organisms and humans tend to be adapted to the climate that they have experienced over the long term. And, you know, when that changes, it's going to require that organisms, including us humans, adapt to the new reality, and we're going to have to.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dan Herms. He's an entomologist at Ohio State University. If you have a question or comment about what you're seeing outside, or a phenomenon like an increase of a certain kind of critter in your garden, go to icechange.org. That's icechange.org. The website just got an upgrade, so it's even easier to use. So log in and share your stories. We're hoping to share more of them on air and keep that climate conversation going. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from Chatham University. Chatham's Falk School of Sustainability offers a bachelor's degree in sustainability and master's degrees in sustainability, food studies, and a dual MBA and sustainability degree. Courses are offered at Chatham's Net Zero Eden Hall campus in Richland, PA, and online. For more information, visit chatham.edu/FALK.
One insect that's been struggling for the last decade is, of course, the honeybee. Now, two scientists in Washington State are teaming up to help the pollinator, and they're investigating an unconventional source for their remedy, the mushroom. Reporting for EarthFix, Ken Christensen has the story.
Eric Olson clutches the lid on top of his wooden beehive. He slowly lifts it up and peeks inside at thousands of stinging insects.
Wow, very nice.
Olson has been a beekeeper in Eastern Washington for half his life.
Look at that.
He loves spending time with his bees, especially when they're doing well.
These girls are fantastic. Those bees are solid across there, and they're making honey and they're making babies.
But just months ago, Olson and his team discovered that nearly half the bees in his 18,000 hives were dead. Olson wasn't alone. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says that nearly half of honeybee colonies across the country collapsed in the past year. Big losses have been happening for nearly a decade, and scientists haven't determined what's causing them. More than 60 factors may play a role in collapsing colonies. Factors like pesticides, disease, and loss of habitat.
If we don't find some answer, I am really concerned about whether these little girls will survive.
But one unlikely source of help for the honeybee may be growing close by. Paul Stamets tromps through the underbrush of the forests of Western Washington. He spots a mushroom growing out of the side of a tree.
Oh, here's another one.
It looks like a little brown shelf with a soft white underside.
All right, here's a great mushroom.
Stamets is a pioneer in the study of mushrooms. He snaps the mushroom off the tree, then he wraps it in wax paper to take back to his lab. He'll turn the mushroom into an extract.
I use mycology and the use of fungi to help clean up the environment and improve the immune system of animals, including people. I began to think, you know, I bet you I can do something to help the bees. These mushrooms, they're like miniature pharmaceutical factories.
Stamets recently partnered with Steve Shepard, a bee expert at Washington State University. They think that fungus might give the honeybee two weapons in a fight against its worst enemy. That's a disease-carrying bug called the varroa mite. Shepard says that varroa mites invade hives, feast on bee blood, and transmit a slew of viruses to their hosts.
I always think of it as having something about the size of a pancake on your back, feeding on you.
Outside his lab near the Idaho border, Shepard crouches so he can peer into a stack of wooden bee boxes. He extends his bare hand and plucks a bee from one of the hives. He quickly spots a varroa mite.
You see her?
It's a pinpoint of reddish brown crawling across the bee's thorax. He bags a few hundred bees from the hive. Back at the lab, he transfers them to little plastic cages. Finally, he fills feeding tubes with a few drops of murky brown juice made from mushrooms. It comes from the lab of Paul Stamets, the mushroom expert who's working with Shepard. They're finding that the mushrooms are reducing viruses in bees and helping them live longer. Next, Shepard and Stamets will test a different type of fungus to see if they can attack the mite directly.
It's certainly encouraging so far.
Shepard and Stamets plan to expand both experiments by partnering with commercial beekeepers.
Wow, I'm really tickled with this.
Like Eric Olson.
I don't have too much hair left. I have pulled my hair out. We just can't seem to get a control on the varroa mite. We've got our fingers crossed.
If they work for Olson and other beekeepers trying out these solutions, the mushroom extracts could find their way into beehives nationwide. I'm Ken Christensen in Yakima.
That story comes from EarthFix, an environmental reporting collaboration in the Pacific Northwest. Want to see how the scientists in the story do their honeybee research? We've got a video on our website. Check it out at AlleghenyFront.org.
Got 100 little flowers in my hair. Got a million dollars dressed to spare. Now I'm walking out your door. The queen, hard to ignore because I am the queen bee. I am the queen bee. I am the queen bee.
Finally today, another installment of our series, talking with people who work and play along the Three Rivers. Pittsburgh's Pete Schell spends his free time catching fly balls. He's not a baseball player. He's what's known as a ball hawk, basically someone who flags down baseballs at major league parks. Typically, that's done inside the ballpark. But Pete has found his own unique hawk's life outside of PNC Park, on the banks of the Allegheny River. During the Pirates' pregame batting practice, he waits patiently for balls that fly beyond the outfield wall.
Heading down, this is the river walk. Boats tie up here, you can see the river and all that kind of stuff. This is where I come down and shag home run balls. I grew up in Chicago, and so balls coming out of Wrigley Field, that's just in your blood. And so when I saw them designing the park and saw the layout, I said, okay, I'll be there. To me, it seemed natural. To most of the people that know me, they think I'm an absolute nut. For those fans that can't see, right behind us, what is that, 20 feet, is the Allegheny River. If you back up too much, you're gonna fall into the river. Don't go back. I mean, every baseball player knows that, right? First step has to be back, or is it in? I never did very well with that. I think my favorite story, and I'm sorry for giving shout-outs, good friend of mine, Pastor Guy Wasco, he was a youth pastor here at our church on the north side. I stop in the office, the guy's like, well, where are you going? I said, I'm going down the river. For what? I said, well, come on. He's a Cubs fan. He understands. So he grabs a glove and comes down with me. Well, he talks to everybody. He's not focused on the ball because I guess pastors focus more on people than they do on baseballs. I'm a hawk. I'm looking for balls, and I see the one coming out. So I'm taking the first step. He doesn't see it. I'm racing after it. The ball bounces. As I'm reaching for the ball, and it's in my glove, I get smacked. The dude tackles me, knocks me down. I'm like rolling around, what just happened? And he's laughing and giggling and cackling, holding the ball. You looking for this? And I still can't believe it. To this day, can't believe that the youth pastor took me down for a baseball.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to PNC Park, the best ballpark in America. Tonight.
The question is, how many baseballs have I gotten? And I really don't have a clue whatsoever. Maybe 300, 400 baseballs, something like that. I give mine away. Just a few weeks ago, up in Brighton Heights, there was a team from Urban Impact Foundation, a wonderful inner city organization here in Pittsburgh that helps kids. And so I saw they were on the fields. I ran home, loaded up a bag full of Major League Baseballs, brought it out, gave it to one of the coaches. I said, look, I got to go. Make sure every boy gets one of these. And there's extra. Give them to the coaches, too. That's what I do with the balls. Just to see the thrill on their face, it's a Major League Baseball, it's worth it. I don't have a trophy room at home for baseballs. That's ridiculous. You'd have to be crazy to collect baseballs. I collect golf balls. I probably have about 1,500 logo golf balls at home. My wife thinks I have 50, so I hope she doesn't listen to this, but I don't collect the baseballs. The dream is to catch one on a fly, and obviously I age each year. I'm 50, almost 54, and I don't know how much longer I can chase balls down out here. I would love to catch one on a fly just to see, do I still have the reactions that I can see it, catch it? Because you only have about a second and a half. You know you're on when a bird flies and you've got two steps on it, right? Yeah, that's just, for me, it's fun. There's people set up chairs and stuff now, and look, they're barbecuing over there. That just gets in my way. But to me, that's not what the river walk's for. It's for catching baseballs during batting practice.
That was Pittsburgher and ball hawk Pete Schell. Pete's story is part of a series of audio postcards by the Allegheny Front's Lou Bluin, exploring stories of the people who shape life on the three rivers. To listen to more from that series, go to alleghenyfront.org/ourthreerivers. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Julie Grant's our managing editor. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.